It's showtime.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
You know, the right to bear arms is because that's the last form of defense against tyranny.
Washington is fundamentally corrupt. There are more words in the IRS code than there are in the Bible.
Made in America, heard around the world. You're listening to Blunt Force Truth. I'm Chuck Woolery, along with my co-host, Rusty Humphreys, because Mark Young is off trying to hypnotize somebody in Toronto.
I've heard of a lot of excuses. Going to hypnotism school, I've never heard that one.
Class on hypnotism. What the heck is that? I mean, you know, I have to ask him when he gets back.
Maybe he could give a hypnotism lesson on Blunt Force Truth.
He's gone for a week. He's going to be hypnotizing people for a week.
Now, he's talked with me about hypnotism. Has he ever hypnotized you?
No, he has never hypnotized me. I'm unhypnotizable.
How do you?
Apparently, you have to be really intelligent to be hypnotized, and I'm not that smart.
Really? Have you asked him to hypnotize you?
No, I haven't.
That would be kind of weird to have a friend be able to do that, because then you don't know what, you know, he's going to make you bark like a dog or something.
Right. Well, I'm normally barking like a dog anyway lately, so you know, there's that.
All right, we have a special guest coming up in just a little bit. His name is Steve Snyder. And he is an author, and he has a book about World War II, and I guess he and I have something in common.
What is that?
My father was killed in Vietnam.
Oh, he was?
Yes.
I did not know that, Rusty.
Yeah, and Steve's father was killed in World War II, and my father was also a pilot. My father flew Cobras.
Really?
Yeah, for people who don't know, those were the badass gunships that if you were in trouble, man, you wanted to see a Cobra coming.
And that's a helicopter, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a helicopter.
Right.
You know, and it's weird because, you know, I'm 53 years old. My father only made it to 24.
Wow.
If you can imagine that. So anyway, so I find what Steve's story is interesting because...
So how old were you when your father died?
3 and a half.
Oh, so you were just a baby.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and you have no memory of him at all?
Or? I have very little memory. I've got, I have two, actually. One, I remember standing up in a crib, looking outside the window, and him bringing a pop gun, a cork gun, in the house for me.
Really?
I remember that. I remember he bought me a pony named Trigger. And then I remember the last time I saw him, we drove up to the tarmac of the airport, and he had his uniform on and his duffel bag, and I jumped out of the car and wanted to go with him.
I'll be darned. Sorry. You have vivid memories of that at 3 years old.
And the scariest thing, though, my wife passed away a few years ago, and people said, you know, oh, you know, your daughters, you know, they're not going to remember this stuff. It's like, oh, really? I was 3 and a half. My father's funeral, they wouldn't let me go. Some woman stood with, we were at my grandmother's house. Some woman stayed there. We planted an orange tree in the backyard, so that we would remember it. And I can go almost the entire day. I remember it. So, you know, our brains are weird.
It's really funny. When my dad passed away, it was sudden and unplanned. He had a aorta aneurysm that killed him. And I was in my 20s, and I remember being at the funeral, and all of his friends were there, and they kept saying, well, let's come up and take a look at your dad. And I couldn't do it. I told him, I said, I don't really want to see him in a coffin. I know he's there, but I don't want to look at him there. I don't want to remember him there. That's not the last thing I want to think about with my dad. And so I never did. I don't regret it, but it was just a...
I think you're 100% right.
I don't know whether I am or not, but...
my grandfather...
I couldn't do it. And when my son passed away, the same thing. I couldn't do that. My daughter passed away. I couldn't do that.
Oh, I had no idea in that.
Yeah, I've lost two children, too.
Oh, wow. So. Well, here's why I know you're right. My grandfather, who I loved, died of lung cancer. And for some reason, the only memory I can... Not the only one, but the one that's burned in my memory... is him in his last days in the hospital bed and just looking like somebody that's about to die in a horrible way. I wish I didn't have that memory.
Mm-hmm.
I completely understand. All right. Well, hey, what a happy way to start Blunt Force.
Well, I mean, yeah, our guest is really going to talk about his dad who died in World War II.
Right. And I want to hear about that. And supposedly, and I've talked to a lot of people who were with my dad when he killed. Supposedly, though, he found the guy that shot down his father's plane.
That's what I heard. Yeah. A German pilot, I suppose.
Yeah.
Shot his father down. That. What are the chances of that happening?
I don't know. So we're going to find out about that. That's absolutely fascinating to me. And so Steve Snyder, excuse me, is his name, and we're going to talk to him in a little bit. When people think of Chuck Woolery, they think of beloved game shows. I know you don't like saying this, but it's true. They liked you because you were a nice guy, and you were in Hollywood, and then you started doing conservative videos, and people, you know, love you for it. But you were never really, you were in Hollywood and you knew the movie people, but you were never a movie person, correct?
No, never a movie person. I was not an actor. I have film to prove it. But I mean, I wasn't. I would not be a good actor, and I wasn't a good actor.
Okay.
I never really aspired to be an actor. I didn't aspire to be a game show host either. It just kind of happened. And I think that probably the reason that I was successful is, number one, I had really good games. I mean, Wheel of Fortune obviously is a great game.
Wheel of what?
Yeah. And Love Connection was a great concept. Scrabble was a great concept. So all of these games were, I think, really hit shows with or without me. It just so happened that I was able to attach myself to them. But I think probably as I look back and realize what I did that maybe endeared me to the audiences, I always had a good time. I always enjoyed myself. I always had fun. And a lot of times, if you're just having fun doing what you're doing, people kind of attach themselves to it. And I had kind of an odd, funny sense of humor, I guess, the way I looked at things. And so,
well, the reason I bring that
without really intending to do it, but I did.
Well, here's the reason I bring this up, because there's a story on the Hill right now.
Mm-hmm.
Will political
on the Hill, like the Hill.com or the Hill?
Hill.com. Uh-huh. Will political correctness kill classic movies? And it's not just movies, it's TV shows. But here's one of the highlights of this story, and I'll read a little bit more, but one that I think kind of affects you because you knew John Wayne.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The stars who made older films great are now seen through the PC prism. Just ask the estate of John Wayne. The legendary star got pummeled a few months ago, decades after his passing, for a racially insensitive Playboy interview in 1971. Some critics are demanding now that his name be stripped from John Wayne Airport in Orange County, California.
Mm-hmm. So what did he say? What was so insensitive?
He observed, "I believe in white supremacy until the blacks are educated to a point of responsibility."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty racist, actually.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. But do we look at things in, I don't know, I guess even back then, would that have been bad, 1971?
Well, yeah, I think so, because, you know, political correctness is a funny thing. Most people have no idea where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know where it comes from?
Absolutely not.
I can tell you exactly where it comes from.
Tell me.
The Frankfurt School in Germany.
Okay.
The Frankfurt School in Germany was a basically communist school. And the Frankfurt School started a lot of things. One was political correctness, and it was started off by demanding people could not say anything against the government, because if they did, they would be held responsible for it. So you had to be politically correct all the time and support the government no matter what, and you couldn't criticize it. That's where politically correct comes from.
Interesting.
And the Frankfurt School is now located in Columbia University in New York. Well, they left Germany. They were communist, Marxist. So, and I've said this before, but I'll say it again, just in case someone missed it. As Hitler came to power, he hated the communists, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to get out of Germany, and they did. And they left Germany, and they went to New York and became part of the campus of Columbia University. So political correctness started off at the Frankfurt School in Germany, and then moved to the campuses of in the 30s, late 30s, of the campus of Columbia University in New York City. So we come by political correctness legitimately through the left.
Wow.
And everything it touches, it destroys. It always has, it always will, and that's the way it is.
But I mean, do you say, I mean, John Wayne, again, who was a friend of yours, a dear friend of yours, I mean,
he said
something that even you just said was a terrible thing to say.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't say that. John Wayne had, the one thing about Duke was that he had no filter. He would just say what was on his mind, and he felt very comfortable doing that because he knew himself. He probably knew that he didn't think that was racist. He just thought that was real,
right.
Whether it was racist or not, or even whether it was real or not. It was what he thought. So I'm not making any excuse for him.
Right. That's how he was. I mean, it's like
very plain spoken.
You could, I mean, can you imagine?
You could say the same thing about white people. I mean, I come from northeastern Kentucky, which is the heart of Appalachia. So there are some really ignorant people who are there, but then, you know, it's how we describe ignorance is interesting to me. I've known some very book learning people who just didn't have any book learning at all, who were very smart, who were deceivingly, smart. So it just depends on how you calculate that.
Will you take a look at the movies today? I mean, did you see Captain Marvel, the movie?
I did not see that.
Okay. Captain Marvel, I grew up with. Was a man, now it's a woman. Okay, the Avengers, big Avengers, and by the way, Captain Marvel is the most powerful of all superheroes now. She can kick anybody. She beat up the Hulk, no problem. There's one scene, and I don't want to ruin it. If you haven't seen Avengers Endgame, it's been out long enough, so too bad if I'm spoiling something. But at one point, the only people that can save everybody is the group of women. And again, I like women, but
I know, but there's this whole false thing going on with perceptions that trying to blur the lines, and they do it successfully. And, you know, it's done through culture and media, and it's not helpful. It's just trying to raise people up to think that they can do things that they can't do literally, legitimately. I mean, women just don't have the physical, ability to compete with men. I mean, you look at this guy who won the weightlifting thing. He's a transgender.
Yeah.
A guy who became a woman, and so now he outlifts all the women. Show me a woman who becomes a man and competes.
Right.
Well, they can't. So they don't. It's insane. But we live in an insane world. It's upside down. So we just need a little sanity.
And is it fixable? You know, Hollywood. Are they ever going to come around?
I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, Hollywood has been on the left for 100 years. Artists always are on the left, and they consider themselves, you know, artistes,
because they base their things in emotion. Right.
Yeah, it's an emotional ride, and so I doubt it. I don't think that they'll ever come around to a conservative point of view, even though it's more practical. It's just not going to happen. It's not much fun for them, I guess.
But, all right, Chuck. Let's get to Steve Snyder. Steve is an author, and Steve, welcome to Blunt Force Truth with Chuck Woolery. I'm Rusty Embry's filling in for Mark.
Hi, Steve.
How are you?
How are you? Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you great.
Yes, you're fine, Steve.
So, first of all, what's the name of your book, by the way?
It's called Shot Down, The True Story of Pilot Howard Snyder and the Crew of the B-17, Susan Ruth.
So your dad was a B-17 pilot.
That is correct.
And how old was he?
He was an old guy. He was 28 years old.
That's right. He would have been an old guy. Well, the 24 and 25 year olds would have been an old guy back then too. I mean, there are a lot of 19 year olds who were flying those planes.
Now, yeah, Steve, you and I have something in common. My father was a pilot and was killed in Vietnam. So, you and I have a little something in common. And, were you pretty young when your father was shot down?
I wasn't born yet. If he hadn't made it back home, I wouldn't be here.
So he survived.
Yes, B-17 had a 10-man crew. Five of them came back home, and five of them did not. Fortunately for me, he was one of the five.
And he was the pilot?
Yeah, and his plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas.
So where was he flying when he was shot down? Was he over Germany, or where was he?
It was a mission to Frankfurt, Germany. They dropped their bombs successfully.
And what year was this?
It was February 8th of 1944.
So toward the end of the war.
Well, no, it was probably kind of in the middle. The 8th Air Force first mission was on August 17th of 1942. And then the war ended on May 8th of 1945. So he was shot down approximately in the middle of the air war.
How many other planes were operating with him when he was shot down?
I forget the exact number. It was like about 350 were in that bombing mission.
350 planes in a bombing mission. Was it a night mission or a day mission?
No, the 8th Air Force only flew daylight precision bombing missions.
Which they found that we were getting killed doing that too, right?
Well, those daytime missions, absolutely.
We were taking heavy casualties during that time.
Yeah, during the early years of the war, especially 1943, the 8th Air Force took devastating losses. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the war, it was 8th Bomber Command's belief that these bomber formations, you know, and all of these hundreds of planes with all these machine guns and firepower could defend themselves from the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe. But sadly, they were sorely mistaken. They couldn't at all.
Mm-hmm. How do you decide to write this book? Hey, do you sit down and you're talking with your dad? I'm guessing your father, is he still around, or did he pass a while ago?
Oh, he died in 2007, and I didn't decide to write the book until 2012.
That makes it harder because your subject isn't available, right?
Well, I had tons of information. I was so fortunate to have so much information about my dad, every one of his crew members, the Belgium people that of the underground that risked their lives trying to help him, that I was just really blessed to have so much information.
So he went down over Belgium?
Yes, right at the French-Belgian border, just north.
In fact, so was he on his way in or on his way out?
They were, trying to get out. They had dropped their bombs successfully, okay. But their bomb bay doors had gotten hit by anti-aircraft fire, black, mm-hmm. and they couldn't get the doors back up. And as a result, that caused a drag in the plane. They was losing airspeed, and they fell behind the formation that was heading back to England, to their bases. And they were singled out by two Focke-Wulf German 190 fighters. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. But both those German fighters were shot down as well.
Oh, so the gunners on the on your dad's airplane actually shot them down as well?
Well, they shot down one of the Focke-Wulfs. The other Focke-Wulf fighter, it was hard to determine who shot that one down. The one that was shot down by was piloted by Siegfried Merrick. He crashed and he died in the plane. And the other was piloted by Hans Berger. And the gunners on my dad's plane did shoot Hans Berger down. He bailed out and made it through the war. And I actually found Hans Berger and interviewed him for the book.
You did?
Yeah. It was amazing.
How did you find this guy?
Yeah. How did you even know it was him?
Well, it's an interesting story. It never even dawned on me to try to find the pilot, because all my dad knew and all the military records showed was that two Focke-Wulf German fighters shot him down. But one day during my research, my wife just casually said, well, why don't you try to find the German pilot? Which I thought was an idiotic idea. There's no way in the world. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do. And I went on Google, posted trying to find a Luftwaffe pilot. A couple forums came up, which I joined, and I posted inquiries on those forums. I knew the day that my dad was shot down, the time of day, the place, and in a week, two guys got back to me, one from England and one from Belgium. And on that day, there were 12 B-17s shot down, and the one shot down south of Chimay, Belgium, was shot down by Lieutenant Hans Berger, who fortunately for me became a translator after the war and speaks perfect English.
Well,
that's awesome.
So what did he say about the event? Did he remember it?
Well, yeah, he remembered it because he was shot down and had to bail out. over occupied Belgium. You know, the Germans controlled Belgium at that time. So, well,
what did he say to you? What, you know, number one, what did you ask him and how did he respond?
Well, for the book, I interviewed him over the telephone and through email. Since in 2016, I actually went and met him in person, though. I was so excited to find him. You know, I was just bombarding him with questions. At one point, he goes, "Steve, you know, you're asking me all these personal questions, and I really hardly know you." But I built up his trust, and he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force. You know, he was just pretty much like the American airman. He was 20 years old, just a young guy fighting for his country, trying to do a job and trying to stay alive. He said it was unfortunate that they had to be shooting against each other, but, you know, that's what they were there to do.
So it wasn't personal?
No. The air war wasn't personal, like, you know, the ground war when you're, you know, up close and personal to the guys that you're fighting against.
Well, I guess if you got shot down, it's pretty personal.
Well, yeah, that's true.
What was the difference in the stories from your dad's story of that event and the story from the guy
who shot him down?
What was how is that story different?
Well, Hans really couldn't remember too many particulars from that day. You know, he remembers, you know, going up and engaging the U.S. bombers and attacking a plane, and then his plane shot down. He bails out. He doesn't remember too many of the details. My dad, on the other hand, after he bailed out, he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture.
Wow.
And why he was missing in action, he wrote a diary about his plane being shot down. It's absolutely riveting, and it's in the book. And he goes into unbelievable detail about, you know, going on the mission and the plane being hit and guys bailing out and the cockpit's on fire. And it's I get chills just talking about it.
Really? Getting back to Hans, what was his last name?
Berger.
Hans Berger. How many planes had he shot down prior to engaging your father? Did he know?
Well,
he obviously was a combat pilot, so he was shooting at something.
Yeah, I forget how many planes he had shot down at that point. All totally shot down 8 planes, so he was an ace. He shot down 7 B-17s and 1 British Spitfire. He himself was shot down 3 times.
Hmm.
So he had quite a history as well.
Yeah, I was trying to get how he would remember details about a certain battle that he was in that perhaps if there were so many, you might lose perspective on detail anyway.
The U.S., the 8th Air Force, well, they implemented a mission limit in the spring of 1943. At the beginning, there was no mission limits, and the morale started going into the tank.
What do you mean mission limits? There were no mission limits. Describe
that. You just flew and flew and flew. And the U.S. Airmen, these combat crews, soon realized that they'd never get home. They would either be killed or be shot down and become prisoners of war. So in the spring of 1943, the 8th Air Force implemented a mission limit of 25. If you hit 25 missions, if you went on 25 missions, then you could go back home.
Mm-hmm.
But even though they implemented that, it was statistically impossible to complete 25 missions in 1943.
That's a lot.
The average number of missions flown before being shot down was 6.
Wow.
Yeah, being a combat airman in the 8th Air Force was the most dangerous duty assignment in the United States military during World War II. 26 million men died in the 8th Air Force, which was more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific.
Good Lord. Holy cow. I had no idea. That's an interesting statistic.
Yeah, and another 28,000 men became prisoners of war after their planes were knocked out of the sky.
Blue Emu works fast and you won't stink. This episode of Blunt Force Truth is brought to you by Blue Emu Pain Relief Products. Now, I've been in show business for many years now, and I'm not slowing down, but I can use a little help every now and then. Blue Emu's family of products are made in America and have become a staple in my life. The deep penetrating formula of Blue Emu Original is best for supporting my muscles and joints, and I'm sure you've seen it. It's on the shelf in a blue and white jar. I also use Maximum Arthritis for any arthritic pain and the Lidocaine Cream for numbing pain relief. Not only do these Blue Emu formulas work great, there's no chill, no burn, and no odor. Blue Emu, it works fast and you won't stink. Available at Walmart, Walgreens, CVS, Amazon, and other fine retailers.
The name of the book, by the way, Shot Down, the true story of pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17, Susan Ruth. Steve Snyder is here with Chuck Woolery. My name is Rusty Evers. You're listening to Blunt Force Truth.
No, I'm just curious as to what made you want to write a book about it, and instead of just kind of passing this information on to your family or something like that, but to actually sit down and create a book around your dad and his experiences. What drove you to do that? I've never written a book, but I would imagine it takes a lot of effort and desire, and obviously you want some particular outcome from it. So you want to share it with the world, I suppose.
Well, I retired from my career job in 2009, and that's when I had the time to really delve into my dad's war history in more detail. I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history growing up. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. He flew bombing missions over Europe, was shot down, but evaded capture. But I just wanted to learn a little more. My parents had kept a lot of material from the war years, and I just wanted to go through that and organize it. And that time, I had no intention at all of writing a book. I just wanted to find out some more. And, reading that diary, as I said, was riveting. And I sat down and read all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in England. And reading those letters was absolutely fascinating. And I became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew, and it really became my passion. I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe, went on the internet, spent countless hours doing research. I joined numerous World War II organizations, started going to reunions, listened to veterans tell their stories. And finally, 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that people needed to know about it and read about it. So I decided to write a book.
Good for you. Now, I noticed, completely off subject, there's a ukulele behind your lamp over there. You play that?
Well, my wife and I are really into the tropics. You'll also see a bunch of tikis there.
Well, I know, but you could be into the tropics and just in tropical drinks. You actually have a ukulele. Do you play that ukulele?
Well, I used to play it a little bit. And in my yard here, I live in Seal Beach, California, about 40 miles south of L.A. I have 75 different species of palm trees growing in the ground. So it looks just like Hawaii.
Wow.
Okay.
Hey, most guys in that era did not like, and even Vietnam guys, they don't like talking about the war. They didn't like talking about the war. Did your dad mind talking with you about this as you were growing up, or was it a taboo subject for him?
Well, that's a good question. Like other World War II veterans, like you mentioned, he didn't talk about it much until 1989. That year, a memorial was erected to my dad and his crew in the little village of Mackinac, Belgium, just north of the French border. And my dad and the three other crew members that were living at the time went over for the dedication. And there he was reunited with all these Belgian people that hid him from the Germans during the war, saw these homes where he was hidden in, and that brought it all back, and he started talking about it. And then 5 years later, I made my first trip to Belgium. I've been there 5 times. I went with my parents, and that's when it became personal for me because I saw all these places firsthand. Southern Belgium is very rural and all farmland, and really nothing's changed in hundreds of years there. So all these places where he and other members of my crew were hidden and where the events took place, you can see today.
Why did they build a memorial to him in that plane? I mean, there were thousands of planes. Why build a memorial to that one?
Well, the people in Belgium, also the Netherlands, they're amazing people. To this day, they are still so thankful and so grateful for the Americans coming to rescue them from Nazi oppression and Nazi occupation. They've erected a number of memorials in the area, and they started in the mid-80s, they formed an association called the Belgium American Foundation to honor and remember the American servicemen who liberated their country. And they erected a number of memorials in the area, and on the anniversary dates of those memorials, like February 8th, every February 8th, they have a ceremony at my dad's memorial. And they're wonderful events. The liberation of Belgium was September 2nd, and that's when the big ceremonies are. And I'm going over for that again this September. I've gathered up relatives of 7 of the 10 crew members on my dad's plane, and there's about 30 of us going over for that. That's really special events. They're wonderful people, and they do a great job of educating the younger generation too, to remember and not forget.
Yeah, I was wondering how long that lasts, because, you know, usually time, it dissipates over a period of time if you don't keep it alive. And it sounds like they're trying to keep the memories of that alive.
Well, that's true. You know, World War II happened over 70 years ago, and the memory of that is fading. And that is really why I do what I do. I do lots of speaking, make PowerPoint presentations. I attend air shows all over the United States. In fact, this weekend I'll be in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And it's just our duty to remember, to remember the air war over Europe, to honor the men who fought it, and to educate the public about it.
I guess my question is, going back to the memorial, what is the importance of that particular flight for the Belgian people? I mean, it was shot down. So why is this one so important that they're going to build a memorial to it?
Well, that was a real significant event in that area. Again, it's very rural. They're just little villages and hamlets that are located there. And it also, it's very historic because some of the members of, I mentioned earlier that five members of my dad's crew came back, but five of them did not. Two of them were killed in the plane when it was attacked. The other eight bailed out successfully. But three of those other, my dad's crewmen, along with five other downed airmen in the area who were hiding in a little hut in the woods, along with two Belgian men, they were captured by the Germans and murdered in the woods of Chimay, Belgium. It's really an incredible story. And it was such a significant event, and it affected the people in that village. I probably wouldn't have written the book if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen, a doctor, Paul Delahaye and Jacques Lalot, who were young boys during the war and greatly affected by it. They saw the atrocities committed by the Nazis firsthand, and later in life they became local historians, and they interviewed all these Belgian people and members of the Belgium underground who hid my dad and other members of the crew about events that took place involving them. And they documented their testimony, and they gave me unbelievably detailed information about events that would have been lost forever without their research. So I owe them a great deal of gratitude. Mm-hmm. And they also provided me with all these pictures. There's over 200 time period photographs in the book, so you can visualize everything that you're talking about.
Oh, is that right? They have pictures of your dad and his crew, what was left of his crew there, and things like that?
Yeah, many of the pictures were taken by Belgian people during the war, during 1944, unbelievably one-of-a-kind pictures.
That is unusual, because I recall, I'm old enough to, I was born during the war, or just prior to it, and we had no film. I mean, you couldn't take a picture, I guess, in the 40s, until maybe 45, 46, there were no film available. And I don't have any pictures of anything, because it just wasn't around. It was all military, and no one had cameras. They couldn't.
Was it because of rationing, or they didn't have the technology?
Yeah, I guess it was. I mean, I'm so young, I can't remember. But yeah, the cameras were like an unusual thing to have film and things like that. So, but they apparently had it there. I think most of the pictures that were taken of me and my friends when I was growing up were taken after the war, when we were maybe 7-8 years old.
There are pictures, because my dad's family, my dad was born in Norfolk, Nebraska. He moved to California with his family when he was 13. But I have all these pictures when he was a kid. He was born and taken in the 1920s.
I'm talking about just literally the war years when America was at war.
Oh, the war years.
Yeah, just the war years in the 40s, early 40s, early to mid 40s.
Well, after my dad bailed out, he came down in some trees, and he was parachute, got hung up in the trees. He was dangling 20 feet off the ground. But fortunately for him, a couple young Belgian men, Raymond Durvan and Henri Franken, came to his rescue before the Germans got to him and helped him down out of the tree. This happened about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and they told him to hide and stay put because it was too dangerous to try to move him in daylight with German patrols combing the area. But they came back and got him that night, took him to the Durvan farmhouse, which is still there today. And after that, the Belgium underground moved him from place to place to place. He might stay one night in one house or 6 weeks in another house. It all depended on how brave the Belgian people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. And one of the houses, the couples that he stayed with, Maurice and Ghislaine Bayou. Their house is still there today, too. He had a pretty job. He was kind of, I guess, well-to-do. So he had a camera, and he took lots of pictures of my dad.
Wow.
With not only them, but with other helpers. There's either even a picture of my dad. Well, I should say, after my dad was missing in action for 7 months, and after a while, he got tired of hiding. So he decided to join the French resistance and fight against the Germans. And
so
there's
your
a picture.
Spoke French or spoke German or was well, he bilingual?
Well, he learned how to speak conversational French while he was even hiding. One of the houses that he stayed at, there was a 16-year-old girl next door named Mimi Gabriel who could speak English. And they would play cards and play Monopoly and do crossword puzzles. And she taught him how to speak conversational French. So by the time he joined the French resistance, you know, he could speak French well enough to communicate.
Were there any close calls of him almost getting captured?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's a number of instances described in the book where he was almost caught by the German secret police, the Gestapo. And then there's a number of instances or encounters in the book about that he had with the Germans attacking convoys while he was fighting with the French resistance.
You know, we talked about something the other day on the last show. Have you talked to many Germans about World War II?
I've talked to a few, yeah.
Here's my question. We were talking about this. We as Americans think that we're good people. Most people think they're good people. Did the Germans at the time think they were good people when they were fighting in World War II? Did they think they were doing the right thing?
Absolutely. When Hitler first came to power, I mean, he did a lot of positive things for the German people. That Germany was was a mess after World War I. The Versailles Treaty is really what caused World War II.
And that was Woodrow Wilson and a bunch of people.
Well, it was the French and the British who just wanted to put it to the Germans. And then the Depression came along. And so it was like 35% of the people were out of work. And they had no pride at all. And Hitler came in and he got the economy going. He put everyone back to work. Everyone had enough food to eat. He instilled national pride. So like when Hans Berger was growing up, I mean, Hitler was a really positive influence and a hero to the German people. Little did they know he'd become this monster that he was. You know, Hans Berger, you know, he was fighting, you know, when he went up in that, his German fighter, he was protecting his country and his countrymen being bombed and killed by the Americans bombers coming over. So yeah, he definitely thought he was doing the right thing. He was protecting his homeland.
It's different when we look at ideology today, what drives people, what happens to them and where they're going, what's good for you, what's bad for you. It's so hard to separate. Unless you really study it, like, for instance, I mean, the Nazis it was the National Socialist, party. They were socialists. Interestingly enough, they were anti-communist, but communists were also socialists. I mean, it's really, they had so much in common, and yet they hated each other.
Oh, they hated each other
just
desperately.
Despised each other. I mean, literally, you know, Hitler ran out every communist he could find in Germany, and they were treated just as badly as Jews or anybody else.
Yeah.
But, and I don't think a lot of people understand that. And yet they had, interestingly, ideologically, they had a lot in common.
Yeah, that's true.
And today we look back and think, you know, we see this socialist movement in our country and realize it's really fascist, Marxist, socialist. It's this of the same ilk. It's all the same stuff. It's bad. It's not good. It's anti-American. And yet people are latching on to it. And that's why I get back to, we think we're good people, you know, standing for good things. And yet America is so unique and so different in our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence, our Bill of Rights. It's all about power to the individual, where all of these countries like Nazi Germany and the Russians and everything, it was really all about the government. Absolutely. And not individual rights. So we are so completely different. And it's kind of hard to see it through the, you know, perspective of history to think, how could you possibly think you were right? Yet they did.
Yeah.
Well, the Nazi propaganda machine was unbelievable.
Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And they
used a lot of projection, which is what the socialists today use. In other words, they would accuse you of what they are and what they're doing, but they were doing really bad things, but they would accuse you of doing those bad things when in fact you weren't doing them at all.
Yeah, the propaganda, it was really brainwashing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they did it slowly over a period of time. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, you know, they would to brainwash them, and then what they were telling them and the propaganda they were giving them was getting, you know, worse and worse and worse. But you know, it was kind of just a gradual thing, like, you know, the boiling the frog in the water. You know, you don't notice how hot it's getting or how bad it's getting until it's too late.
Was that pilot who was protecting his homeland from the evil Americans, does he feel bad now?
Oh yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
In what way? What did he do wrong?
Well, the mask came off, really.
He didn't do anything wrong, but when they found out when he found out what he was going on, you know, during the war, he's stationed he was at different air bases in mostly in occupied Europe. So every day he's fighting the war. He doesn't know what's going on in Germany.
Right.
Now the German military was kind of divided in two. You had the regular old military. The regular army, what was the Wehrmacht, and then you had the SS, which was the armed, you know, forces of the Socialist Party, and those were the guys that ran the concentration camps, and those were really the murderers, as opposed to the Wehrmacht. Not to say that the Wehrmacht didn't do anything wrong, but there was a difference between the military forces of the Socialist Party and the military forces, you know, of the regular army.
Yeah, they were at odds with each other. I mean, the Germans, there were a lot of generals who didn't agree with Hitler at all.
Oh, yeah, he was, I forget how many times they tried to assassinate him.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there were a number of times they tried to get rid of him, but but then anytime they did, Hitler would just have this big purge and just, you know, kill thousands of people.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like Hussein in Iraq. If you're enemies, you just grab and kill everybody, have a big meeting and kill them all. Drag them out.
Yeah. If you disagree, you're gone. Or if they think you might disagree.
Steve Snyder's our guest. The name of the book is Shot Down, The True Story of Pilot Howard Snyder and the Crew of the B-17. Susan Ruth. Is that right?
Yes, Susan Ruth.
Susan Ruth. How long is the book? The book's just come out, or has it been out for a while?
It's been out for a while. It was released in almost 5 years ago, in August of 2014. Since that time, it's won over 25 book awards. It has a 5-star rating on Amazon, and it's really changed my life. I work full-time involved in the book.
So how can our readers find it if they want to, or our listeners, how can they find the book if they would like to have it?
Well, most people get it on Amazon. Over 50% of all the books purchased are purchased on Amazon. It's available as a hardback, also a paperback in all ebook formats, Kindle. It's available as an audio book. If anyone wants a signed copy of my book, they can go on my website, which is Steve Snyder, Snyder, author.com, Steve Snyder, author.com. And then the homepage, you can order a signed autographed copy. And there's lots of information about not only my book, but about the 8th Air Force and the air war over Europe on my website.
So, Steve, are you still in Seal Beach, California?
Yeah.
Is that where you live? Yeah. And you've lived there how long?
Well, I was born in Pasadena, California. And then graduated from UCLA, and then moved down to Seal Beach a couple of years after I graduated. I've lived here since 1972.
That's a pretty area of California. I know it well. I do.
Yeah, it's nicknamed Mayberry by the Sea. It's a quiet little place.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, we're happy to have you on the show. Thank you for sharing your experience with your dad as a World War II pilot. And I wish you all the best with your book. And if our listeners want to buy your book, they can go on Amazon, pick it up. And is there anything else that you'd like to leave us with before we say goodbye?
Yeah, just one maybe closing comment. There was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. Mm-hmm. 60 million people died. Millions more were wounded. Millions more were left homeless and displaced. It changed the course of the world and America forever. And the brave young men who fought and died for freedom are without doubt the greatest generation. And their sacrifice must never be forgotten.
Well, thank Amen. You for that. And you're absolutely right. Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
Well, thank you.
I really enjoyed it. Anything we can do to help, let us know. We'll put you on our board and make sure that people can find everything they need to know about your book through our, what is that called, Rusty?
BluntForceTruth.com.
Yeah, right? BluntForceTruth.com. I just wanted to hear him say it one All more right. time.
Thanks, Steve. All right, thank you, Steve.
Buddy.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay,
right.
thanks again.
So bye-bye. We do want to remind everybody, go to BluntForceTruth.com. You can get the swag and the T-shirt and the bumper stickers and the coffee mugs and all the cool Chuck Woolery stuff.
Yeah, right.
We need more Chuck Woolery stuff, I think.
I know. Again, thank you, our guest, for being on the show today. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you next time on Blunt Force Truth.